Atheist Nomads, episode 441, The Huguenot Diaspora.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and joining me is Lauren.
Hello.
And, sorry this one's a little late. I started digging into my family connection with the French Huguenots. And pretty quickly discovered there was a lot more there than I thought. And
yeah, lost them down a rabbit hole.
Way more details, because they were actually pretty important people. So instead of it just being a little side bit on this, it's actually ended up being most of it, and it's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So you ready to dive in?
Sure thing.
For if you missed last week's episode, we talked about the Huguenots and the persecution and the civil wars and all of that last week. One of the things that wasn't quite covered and is important for this one is just north of France, the region currently known as Wallonia, that is French speaking and part of Belgium.
Okay. Wallonia sounds kind of made up.
But yeah, it's the French speaking half, and the Dutch speaking half of Belgium is called Flanders. Back in the 1400s, all the French-speaking part was under the French crown. By the 1500s, it had moved over to the Holy Roman Emperor.
Oh, okay.
Who was Austrian Habsburg. And then it got handed off to the Spanish Habsburgs.
Sounds like nobody really wanted it, but okay.
Along with the rest of the Low Countries. Which had been under the imperial throne the whole time, and then those got handed on over. That region was called Flanders. The whole region was called Flanders. And the southern parts of Wallonia, France had totally lost. Eventually, they got it back. So, borders move.
Oh, okay.
and
why it still is French-speaking.
Yeah. Borders do move, and there's also some interesting stuff with the region about the French language or languages. Wallonian French is considered archaic. And like even back in the 15, 1600s.
The olden French.
Was considered a pretty archaic French dialect. There are some scholars who do consider it to be its own language. One of the French languages, but the French government only recognizes French as being a single language.
Right.
They do not allow for
Parisian
that.
French is French.
Yep. And Norman French and Pictish, and Picard and Wallonian are just French to them. To others, they are their own separate languages. There were, and with the Protestant Reformation in the 15 and 1600s, there were Protestants everywhere. And the term French Huguenot generally applies just to French people within the boundaries of the French kingdom at the time, but also often it applies, and back then apparently did also apply quite a bit, to the French-speaking people in what was then Flanders.
Okay. The Walloons.
Yes.
Wallonians.
Walloons.
Walloons.
So, that's where my family connection is with the Walloons, who were in Flanders. The area where they were in had been under the Spanish crown since at least 1550.
Okay.
It is currently part of the Nord department of France, so far northern France.
Okay.
Right on the border region. And we're going to start off with the Dubois family, since turns out I had five ancestors that actually fled the persecution of the Huguenots. We're going to start off with the Dubois family. They had long been lords of the village of Anakin, which was near the city of Lille in the far northern reaches of France that then became, part of Flanders.
Okay.
Because of the feudal system.
Then became a part of Belgium.
Which is now part of France again.
Now part of French. Okay.
Because it was the feudal system, it didn't matter to them whether their king was in Paris, Vienna, or Madrid, because it was just the feudal system.
Right.
They reported to the higher-up lord. There were times when they were also the count, so in charge of a much larger region, but it was kind of all over the place.
Pretty much you kept your head down and you just remained pleasantly peasantry.
Yeah. Well, as was, we talked about last time, the Huguenot movement was really popular among the higher echelons of society, including the nobility.
Okay.
The Dubois family became Huguenots around 1550. By that time...
And a Huguenot is just a very anti-Pope Protestant
French. It specifically refers to a French-speaking or just straight-up French Calvinist Protestant.
Okay.
The lord in the family at 1550 was the older brother of my ancestor.
Okay.
And he ended up siding with William of Orange in the civil war that became the Dutch War of Independence.
Oh, okay.
So he chose to support the Protestant William of Orange instead of the Spanish King of Spain.
Okay.
Quick correction coming in from editing. Yeah, it definitely wasn't William of Orange. He got in trouble for supporting the Protestant Republicans from the northern provinces that become the United Provinces and eventually Netherlands. William of Orange was more than a century later. So, okay, back to what we recorded yesterday. As a result, he got put on trial, was stripped of his lordship,
yeah,
had his properties all confiscated, and was exiled.
Okay.
His son then became lord, and 10 years later had to sell it.
Ouch.
Well, when they confiscate all of his lands and property and everything,
goes the wrong side, right?
What's his son going to be able to do?
Right.
Now, apparently, because my ancestral line by that point was a junior branch of the family, they didn't get that kind of treatment.
Right. They were cousins. Who cares?
Well, brother.
Well, the brother's kids were cousins of...
Yeah. So they didn't care about them, and apparently they got to keep their land and money and government offices.
Insult to injury, huh?
Yeah. So by the time we get to the... Then we get to my 8 times great-grandfather, Louis Dubois. His father, Crichton, was a government official. He still had basically some of the titles that had been in the family, even though he was not a lord.
Okay.
But he did do government stuff for the government.
Upstanding young citizen.
And had a very nice estate and a lot of money. Louis did a apprenticeship in couture, or dressmaking.
Fancy dressmaking.
Fancy dressmaking.
Well, it's fancy if it's in French.
Well, and if you're in a... if you're a nobleman and French, and in a region that was specifically known for its fine textiles at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, he learned how to make super fancy clothes. Finished his apprenticeship by the age of 16, and there is actually a note in the local archives that actually says... It makes sure that you recognize that, no, he actually was done with his apprenticeship by then because he was so smart.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Smart enough that at the age of 16, he sold his birthright to his uncle and got the hell out.
Oh.
There was a French army marching in, and he got out.
How do you sell a birthright? I assume you just sign a piece of paper saying that you're never going to come back and claim anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's worth money?
They figured out a way to make it worth money. You could sell lordships.
I didn't know that.
Selling the birthright, that was basically he was selling his part of his inheritance to his uncle. Okay. Cashing out the inheritance. Considering that his dad died just a couple years later, I wouldn't be surprised if his uncle did as well. And if the French army just killed them all as they were going through. So he got out. So yeah, this would have been about 1642. In the year 1642, the French army besieged the city of Lille, which was just a few miles away from them.
Yes,
they were there. And while the Huguenots did not have much tolerance from the being in the Spanish Netherlands, it was better than what was going on in France at the time.
Active armies.
And this was also in the middle of the 30 Years' War, after France had joined the war, and France had already marched through Wallonia several times.
Okay.
So this was like their last
time. They're sick of it. Okay.
He was 16. He could get out. He got out. And he did.
Smart.
In 1648, the Peace of Westphalia was signed, which ended the 30 Years' War. By that time, Western Germany was the heart of the destruction from that war. And for kind of a brief summary of the 30 Years' War.
Yeah, how long did that last?
From 1618 to 1648. In the first phase, it was Protestant. Well, it all started over the who got the Palatine electorate. And the electorates at the time were, there were prince electors who would were the ones who got to elect the Holy Roman Emperor.
Oh, okay.
So those were the super high princes, even if their lands were not particularly important. Well, the electorate of the Palatine,
I keep thinking you're saying that, say Palpatine.
The elector, prince elector died. There wasn't a clear successor, and they managed to get a Protestant in over the Catholic, who probably had the better claim to take over that region.
Okay.
So that started a war.
It's all Protestant versus Catholic.
In this time period, absolutely.
Okay.
So you ended up having war as a result of that. It started out with just within that region, the parties that were supporting the Protestant claim to the electorate versus the parties that were supporting the Catholic claim. It then grew to include Prussia and Austria, Prussia being Protestant and Austria being Catholic.
Okay.
As the Catholics were starting to win, Sweden, which at the time was one of the most powerful countries in Europe, they weren't by the end of the 30 Years' War and their war with Denmark-Norway.
Were they Protestant?
They were Protestant.
Okay.
So Sweden joined in on the side of the Protestants.
Okay.
And
wrecked their country.
By that time, Spain was also actively involved because they were Habsburgs. They were the brothers and cousins of the Austrians. And Italy, Northern Italy, was also involved because it was also ruled by the Habsburgs. And so you had this massive war going on.
There's a fun Wikipedia rabbit trail.
Most of the fighting was centered on the Palatine region.
Okay.
Then the wild card was played. About halfway through, 1635, France joins. The Protestants...
They had a serious case of FOMO.
Yeah. The Protestants had been trying to keep France out because France was a Catholic country that was actively persecuting all of the Protestants in their country.
Right. They were being real dicks about it.
Instead, France joined on the side of the Protestants.
What?
Because they hated Spain.
You know what? Fuck you, buddy.
And specifically, they wanted Barcelona.
Oh, God.
And Wallonia. And
they wanted the territory.
They wanted the territory.
So they got into war for a good old-fashioned reason.
Yep. And so they marched down into Spain. They conquered Barcelona. They marched all the way through the Spanish Netherlands. They, of course, got beat back. Finally, in the end, the Peace of Westphalia is signed. Included in it, because Germany lost tons and tons and tons of people in this process. Like, villages were burned down. Cities were burned down. Some regions, like the Palatine region, lost 50% of their population.
Wow.
Some of the more lightly touched places only lost a quarter. The ones that got off scathed were merely decimated, losing only 10% of the population.
Yikes.
Yeah, lucky if you're decimated is bad. So included...
I just realized that that's what decimated means. Yeah. 10%.
Yep, losing a tenth.
Wow.
Yeah. Included in the Peace of Westphalia was a provision that would allow Huguenots to resettle in Germany. France wanted them out. Germany wanted them in. There's one little catch. It was specifically written into the Peace of Westphalia that that only applied to areas under the control of the French crown, not the areas under control of the Spanish crown, which meant Huguenots in France could go, but Huguenots in Wallonia could not.
Oh, okay.
Most of Germany stuck to that. The Palatine region was so heavily depopulated, they'd take anyone.
Yeah.
So Louis Dubois took that offer and by 1650 had settled in the Palatinate region near the town of Mannheim.
Okay.
Home of Mannheim University and probably where the Mannheim and Mannheim steamroller. Meanwhile, back in Flanders, Matthew Blanchan was a Wallonian Huguenot. He was born in 1606, and he was rich and came from a rich family. His trade was farming and distilling.
Oh, that's handy.
So in his honor, I am drinking scotch.
Well, okay,
it's the wrong whiskey, but he made whiskey. I was torn between in the honor of my French ancestors drinking wine, because that's more stereotypically French, but no, he distilled whiskey, so I am drinking whiskey.
It was either Scottish whiskey or Californian wine, so I mean, you're not really on the bullseye either way.
Nope. And he married Magdalena Joar, who was Roman Catholic.
Okay.
They had two children. Oh, and interestingly, all of the Dubois children and all of the Blanchan children were baptized in the Catholic Church.
No.
Everybody still got baptized in the Catholic Church.
It's just a matter of record keeping, right? I mean...
Record keeping and also cover.
You cover your ass.
You don't want somebody to be able to go through the books and figure out, oh yeah, you aren't Catholic.
Right. People do it nowadays, too.
Yep. And also, interestingly, for the Dubois family, historians who have looked for records about them have found the original records have been intentionally smudged.
Destroy the records, cover the trail. You
know, Louis and his siblings were baptized, but their names are intentionally smudged out. Actually, I think on his record, it's his dad's name is smudged out.
Hmm.
There were serious efforts at that time period to...
Was that to out them as Huguenots?
It was to erase Huguenots from the nobility.
Oh, okay.
Make sure that nobody could make claim. And if they could find a way to make it...
Only be nobility if you were Catholic in this case?
They were trying to make it so you could only be noble if you were Catholic.
Okay.
They eventually did.
Ah.
Actually, they eventually made it so that you could only be alive if you were Catholic.
Right. again, they're being dicks about it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But the Blanchans, so they had two children, Catherine and Maria. And in the 1640s, presumably 1642 would be my guess when the French army was on its way. They got the hell out of Flanders and went to England. They had money, so they could afford to do that.
Okay.
It's worth noting that out of the 2 million Huguenots at its peak, that number shrunk a lot by people leaving, but it was probably only 300,000, maybe 500,000 that left.
Oh.
The rest were either killed or forced to convert back to Catholicism. So they had money so they could leave. These were the Huguenots who had enough privilege to get out.
Yeah.
Louis was able to get money from his uncle to get out of town. The Blanchens apparently had the money to get out. And while they were in England, it appears they ended up settling in Canterbury, where they had a third daughter in 1647. And by 1651, they had also arrived in Germany, answering that same call to help repopulate the Palatinate region. And they found the Walloon Huguenot community near Mannheim, and they settled there and had two more children.
Okay. That's the Dubois?
This is the Blanchens.
Oh, sorry.
These two families then came together October 10, 1655, when Louis and Catherine got married.
Okay.
They'd started probably
similar backgrounds.
Yeah, a few miles apart. They found the same Walloon Huguenot community, and actually kind of sounds like Louis helped found that community that they then settled in and also helped grow.
Made babies.
But being in West Germany was not particularly comfortable for these Huguenots, considering, you know, the Germans were great, but they were way too close to the French border.
Okay.
And they grew more and more uncomfortable that a French army would show up and make them flee their home again.
Yeah, I'm sure they were being threatened all the time.
So, starting with Matthew, Magdalena, and their three youngest children, they boarded a ship called the Golden Otter, and they sailed to New Amsterdam, but is now New York.
Okay, because apparently that was more comfortable. Nah.
They landed on April 26, 1666, and then Louis and Catherine followed on August 6, 1661. Catherine's other sister and her husband, the sister's husband, so Maria and her husband, they sailed with them. And two of Louis's brothers, had also made the trip at some point.
Okay, so it was a big family.
A bunch of families.
Well, a bunch of families. That whole community, half the community probably left.
Yeah. Once they got there, they first, you know, they got into New Amsterdam and didn't want to be in the big city. So they went up the Hudson into the rest of the New Netherlands.
Okay.
And found the town of Wiltiuk. They settled there for a while.
Not a very attractive name.
It's a Dutch name. And they also found they didn't like the town.
Okay.
It was
wilty and yucky.
Very noisy, very busy. It was a hub of fur trading and farming. And there was lots of bars and drinking and prostitution, and they decided that wasn't where they wanted
not quite
to
the right fit.
Raise their families. So they all packed up and moved to Herley, which was also being called New Village because it was the new village they had just established.
Sounds like suburbia.
Well,
if you were a new village, you'd be home by now.
Things did not go well for them in New Village because the government in the first Espos War had seized 10 of the Espos people and shipped them down to the Dutch Caribbean to work on plantations.
Who are slaves? What's Espos?
A Native American tribe.
Oh, okay.
And so the local natives were generally not happy.
For their people being sold into slavery?
Yeah. Yeah. And then also them being driven off of some of their best farmland for these white people to move in.
Yeah.
So, but the peace was being maintained. The chief repeatedly asked the leadership in Herley to stop giving their young men liquor.
Because they were good little Protestants.
Who kept selling liquor to the local Indian population, where several young men got belligerently drunk.
As to be expected.
Complete asses of themselves and then passed out on a lawn.
Get off my lawn!
In response, a bunch of the white people decided to try to kill them.
Oh, well, that makes sense, right?
They failed, but it was the last straw. The Espos tribe, while most of the men were away from the village, showed up, captured all the women and children, and burned the town to the ground.
Ouch.
They then went on to Wiltiuk and started, Wiltiuk, and started burning it to the ground and capturing the women and children.
Jesus.
But a armed militia showed up and drove them away.
Okay.
Catherine and Louis and Catherine's two children were among those captured, and they were well taken care of as captives, but somewhere in the ballpark of 50 women and children held in captivity for 2 months before the governor got a army together and hunted them down and rescued them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Welcome to the new world.
Yep.
You won't get the French army, but it's not going to be peaceful either.
So after that, they moved further up. Oh, and Wiltiuk is now Kingston, New York. They moved on up to where...
How colonial sounding.
Yeah. Where Louis worked with 11 other men to negotiate a land patent. And this was coordinated with the Espos tribe and the governor of New Netherlands.
Okay.
To create terms that everybody was going to be happy with. And they did compensate the tribe with...
A bunch of stuff.
Cloth and food and horses and tobacco and gunpowder and a bunch of stuff to get 40,000 acres.
Okay.
Where they established the town of New Paltz, named in honor of the Paltatine region in Germany.
Okay. Right.
But specifically, the locals considered it New Mannheim.
Okay. Well, that...
Yeah. This is a city that is still around with a population of 7,300 now. It was settled by these French Huguenots. It was almost entirely established by French Huguenots. And almost entirely Wallonian French Huguenots.
Do you think they speak with an accent there?
Not anymore.
Wow.
And they set up a bizarre corporate government for the town called the Douzine, where the 12 partners that had acquired the royal patent had a government that continued well into the 1800s.
Oh.
It was even allowed to continue for a while by special action of the New York State Legislature because it worked. It was a board of 12 that ran the town.
Okay.
And then from there, the population scattered and spread. And my ancestral line from them mixed with some Dutch inhabitants of New Amsterdam, or of New Netherlands. And then they mixed with my English ancestors from the Mayflower and Plymouth as they all migrated gradually towards New Jersey.
New Jersey. They all end up in New Jersey.
So that's the family connection. And that's actually a pretty good example of how Huguenots fled. It wasn't poor people, it was rich people.
Right, the poor people died.
Yeah, the poor people died. The rich people could get out. And the ones who got out were having to stay away from wars. The ones that were leaving during the 30 Years' War had the toughest time finding safe places to go. Like, England really was the option. And, like, I don't know where Louis was for the 8 years between when he left and when he settled in Mannheim. That's not recorded. He found somewhere to...
Hunker down,
lay low. He could have also been in England, but there's no record of where he was at that point. The lack of records is either he didn't leave a paper trail and did not let that be known, or nobody recorded it. The fact that they were a family who established a town that is still a city in the state of New York makes them worthy of study even till now, and they do get historical...
Heck, 200 years ago, people were still documenting this stuff.
So. Yeah, and they still get people digging into it and looking into it. Add to it the fact that their descendants include the likes of George Patton, World War II general, George Lucas, Maria Shriver, and a bunch of other people. Yeah,
right.
Of course.
Well-studied.
A bunch of celebrities. So yeah, they're well-studied. Other Huguenots who got out of France, like in the early days, they went to Switzerland and the Netherlands. In those early, early days, the Netherlands would have been better, but not by much. They were getting much less persecution under Spanish rule. A bit later, after, you know, after 1570, they could go to the Dutch Netherlands and actually have freedom of religion. Like, that was the first place where freedom of religion was a thing.
But they didn't.
Well, some did.
Oh, sorry. I thought we were still talking about that.
Not particularly my family. Other Huguenots that got out. There were also a lot who went to Switzerland. During the 30 Years' War, neither option was good. There were a couple ships with around 500 people who, in 1555, tried to found France Antarctique, which was at basically modern Rio de Janeiro.
Oh, wow.
And so they landed, they settled on a small island, they built a fort then to protect themselves against the Portuguese and Brazilian natives.
How did that go?
Well, so they landed 1555. The fort was destroyed in 1560 by the Portuguese, who captured some of the Huguenots, and then they were threatened with death if they did not convert to Catholicism.
Okay, so they did not fare well.
No. Well, actually, they doubled down. They wrote the Guayabara Confession of Faith to explain their beliefs and were immediately executed.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't go to a Catholic-controlled region if you're trying to flee Catholic persecution.
Sounds like they just kind of landed there. They didn't really know where they were going. But they landed there, so settle they did for 5 years.
Yeah. A number of Huguenots settled in South Africa. The earliest documented arrival was Maria de la Clary, and who was the wife of Commander Jan van Riebeck and the daughter of a Walloon church minister. So she married a Dutch man and got out.
Okay.
Smart move.
Yeah.
They arrived in April of 1652 and helped establish the settlement that became Cape Town.
Oh, okay.
Then they left 10 years later for Batavia, which is modern-day Jakarta, Indonesia.
Oh, whoa.
At that time, the Dutch East Indies. Right. Well, it wasn't yet the Dutch East Indies. At that time, it was a trading post.
The pre-Dutch East.
Yeah. In 1687, the first organized group of Huguenots left the Netherlands to a Dutch East India Company post at the Cape of Good Hope. And most that came to settle did so by 1689, with a total of 7 ships as part of a actually organized migration of Huguenots from the Netherlands to South Africa.
Okay.
There were a lot who initially settled somewhere and then decided they didn't like that and wanted to go somewhere else where they could found their own communities as opposed to being stuck in others.
Yep. Because they were just different enough.
Yeah. These settlers were given land in an area that would become known as Franschhoek, which is Dutch for French Corner, and it is in the Western Cape province of South Africa today. There is a large monument commemorating the arrival of the Huguenots in South Africa that was installed in 1948.
Oh, wow.
And the Huguenot Memorial Museum was built there in 1957.
Huh, cool.
Official policy was Huguenots needed to integrate in with the Dutch communities, and they did. But they did allow them to get a French pastor to replace the pastor that had traveled with them. But Huguenots everywhere they settled integrated in. You know, you can see that with my ancestors who within the first generation born in, you know, New Netherlands / New York, they married into Dutch families, and within a couple more generations married in with English families.
Yeah.
And yeah, they integrated quickly. And as a general rule of thumb, within three generations, Huguenots everywhere would adopt the language of the area they were in and would pretty thoroughly integrate in.
Wouldn't become Catholic.
But not Catholic. There are still quite a few farms in the Western Cape province that have French names. And there are also many families from Afrikaans-speaking communities in the Cape province who have names suggesting they were of French descent, including De Klerk, which would come from the French Le Klerk.
Yeah.
And that was one of the presidents of apartheid South Africa.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. South Africa's wine industry also is largely because of Huguenots who had vineyards in France.
You snuck some vines out, huh?
Helping start some vineyards there.
Okay.
Also a number who were brandy distillers who brought that skill in too.
Distillers, man.
The North American settlements, you know, we talked quite a bit about the settlements in New Netherlands. New Netherlands was actually a much larger region than just the lower Hudson and New York City. It also included, after the Dutch-Swiss War, they captured New Sweden, which gave them parts of Delaware, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania.
Oh.
And so there was a pretty large Huguenot settlement in Pennsylvania, including the town of Dubois, Pennsylvania, which was founded by a brother of Louis Dubois.
Okay.
In many of the places around the U.S. where there were those early Huguenot settlements, you'll find streets called Huguenot Street. You'll find French neighborhoods named after, you know, French something. Those were all Huguenot settlements.
Louisiana?
New France would include Louisiana. And Huguenots were explicitly prohibited from settling in New France.
Ah.
So it was the Dutch territories where they were allowed.
Right, because New France would have been anti-Huguenot. Anti-Huguenot. Okay.
If they got found out, they would have been killed.
Yes.
Yeah. So
they, not Cajun.
Yeah, not Cajun at all. The non-Cajun French in America.
Okay.
There was also an attempt to settle in Florida. They thought they could get away with it, but the Spanish found them and did not like the idea of French Protestants living in Florida, so they made them leave, and they ended up settling in what's now Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh.
Where there is the only French Huguenot church with its own building.
You should have your brother check it out.
I should. But yeah, it's currently the largest Huguenot community that's still in the U.S. that still identifies as Huguenot.
Okay.
By and large, all other Huguenots just integrated in and mixed in with the population. In particular, the Huguenots in the Huguenot Church in New York merged with the Dutch Reformed Church.
Okay.
And that is eventually became the Evangelical Lutheran Church in the U.S.
Oh, okay.
There was a lot of merging various,
and yeah.
Yeah.
Renaming and so on and so forth.
Yeah. There, of course, were many, many Huguenots who settled in the Netherlands. A lot used that as an opportunity to for a jumping board to elsewhere. It was just a safe place they could get to that wasn't all that far, if they could get to it.
Yeah.
Great Britain and Ireland, England being a Protestant country by that time, took in lots of Huguenots, such as the Blanchman family. Most of them settled in Canterbury, which was the Calvinist hub of England.
Oh, okay. Those crazy Calvinists.
Edward VI actually granted them the western crypt of the Canterbury Cathedral to hold their church services.
Is that like the basement? Is it the equivalent of being, he goes, okay, yeah, you guys can have the basement.
Basically, yeah. Then after, in 1825, in 1825, that privilege was dropped down to just the South Aisle. And in 1895, they then could only have the Chantry Chapel of the Black Prince. And there are still church services in the Reformed tradition in French at the Chantry Chapel of the Black Prince at Canterbury every Sunday at 3 p.m.
It just sounds cool. The Black Prince.
When the French government revoked the Edict of Nantes, that was the one that granted limited tolerance.
Yeah.
A bunch of Huguenots went to Ireland, specifically in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. And that was because the English government was trying to get as many Protestants into Ireland as possible.
Oh, okay. They weren't driving them out, but they were trying to supplant the Catholics.
Yes.
Okay.
So Huguenots settling in Ireland, probably mostly in the northern part of Ireland, is a factor in why Ireland has a Protestant north and a Catholic south.
Yeah. Because if you don't have a war, make one.
Yeah. And there were Huguenots who had served as mayors in Dublin, Cork, Hugh Hall, and Waterford in the 17th and 18th centuries. And you can find place names such as the Huguenot District and French Church Street in Cork City that allude to the Huguenot presence. Scotland also took quite a few Huguenots. That was in part because Scotland and France were very, very ancient allies, and so it was a little more friendly option. A friendly country with friendly Protestant country.
Okay, yeah.
Germany we already covered. It was pretty common to, not just in Western Germany, there was also a fair number who settled in Prussia. Some went up into Scandinavia. There were even a few who went to Russia.
Well, they go wherever they can not be killed.
They were refugees fleeing,
right, yeah,
horrible persecution. The ones who got out were among the few who got out alive.
Yeah.
It's a...
Just end up in Russia. Ouch. Well, no, Russia's beautiful. It's just...
Well, and like my ancestors...
On the winter.
They left Germany because they were afraid of a war coming. And so they went to New Netherlands where they helped start a war.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like,
they keep the ball rolling.
They basically arrived right in the middle of King Philip's War. Like, it was, yeah. this is a topic I've been wanting to cover on the show for a long time, because I knew nothing about, well, I knew almost nothing about Huguenots.
Huguenots.
Basically, all I knew from my education was that they were French Protestants.
Right.
And
which,
yeah, like it'd come up in classes about the Reformation. Yes, and the Protestants in
France. Most of us have heard the term Huguenot and just didn't know what it was.
Right.
So that's cool.
And then I saw, I found out I had an ancestor who's a Huguenot. I was like, oh, I want to dig more into
whose name is like where you live.
And
which is awesome.
Yeah, Dubois.
The
Boissy is from Le Bois.
Le Bois, Le Bois. The woods. Yep, Boissy's. That's pretty funny.
And Boissy's name is because the cottonwood trees along the Boissy River were a sign that you'd found the oasis in the desert. My ancestor's name, Dubois, was probably because they were the masters or lords of the woods. Obviously, also villages and farms around them, but...
Well, yeah, but yeah, mostly woodland.
But the woodlands.
It's pretty cool.
A royal line dating back into the Norman period with a Dubois riding with William the Conqueror. And yeah, pretty cool. The Huguenot diaspora also, it was bad for France. Like, obviously, a bunch of civil wars and then being part of a very massive war and a lot of persecution and violence is bad for your country. But yeah, there were a lot of peasants that were Huguenots. There was also a lot of nobles and scholars.
Yeah, to actively drive out a huge segment of your population is kind of shot in the foot. But
and all of the Huguenots who had money got out, which meant the doctors, the lawyers, the businessmen, the distillers,
the couturists.
Yeah, they all got out.
Yeah.
And it definitely hurt France. It's been described as a brain drain on France. It boosted Germany, especially Prussia. And much like how the Spanish Inquisition driving the Jews out of Spain caused Spain's economy to decline, Poland took them in and had a golden age.
Yeah.
Like, you don't drive out
the rich smarties.
You're, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That wraps that up. We have feedback.
Woo!
It's from the new voicemail line.
Woo!
Which, whoa, that was not what I wanted. Which you can find if you call 208-996-8667.
Couldn't quite get that 666, huh?
I didn't look that hard.
Okay.
But there are six. There are three sixes in it.
Okay, that's good.
If you call the voicemail line, please leave your name. Otherwise, you will be anonymous.
Which is fine.
So we have an anonymous caller.
All right.
Hey, love your podcast and hope the system is working for all the voicemails and stuff like that. Keep up the good work. I always learn something new and interesting that I probably wouldn't have figured out on my own by listening to your podcast. Thank you for doing such good work.
Thank you. That means a lot. And
thanks for being our guinea pig, too.
Yes. I like covering interesting topics about stuff most people... Actually, I love the most covering topics where it's stuff I don't know a lot about either. Just enough to be curious and then dig in and find more.
And then I just sit around and ask questions.
That's
fine. And it's all good.
And of course,
that's how you learn.
Of course, with the upcoming rebranding, the goal is to do even more of that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, glad you're enjoying it. And thanks for the voicemail. That came through great. And I would say that the voicemail recorded by Twilio worked. It was much higher quality than I ever got from Google Voice. And that is better quality
or
than I've gotten from SpeakPipe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just call the voicemail line, 208-996-8667. We don't have any new patrons, But if you want to support the show, you can find out how at atheistnomads.com/donate. The new website is still in development, but if you want to check it out, you can find it at htotw.com, which is short for Humanist Take on the World, or you can actually just spell out humanisttakeontheworld.com, and that will also take you there. Lauren, thank you so much for staying awake.
All right, thank you.
And listeners, remember, not all those who wander are lost.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.